We are finishing up our series that we've been doing for 6 weeks now called Parting Words. We've been looking at the last statements, the phrases of Jesus on the cross. And today I'm excited as we finish this up and we get ready for Easter Sunday, which is going to be a party, okay? We got sad Saturday, like Janine said, and happy Sunday. Okay, so I'm sitting next to my wife on a plane about to take off in the middle of the night in Guatemala. And we're surrounded by high school students because we've just been on a mission trip. And for many of these students, this is their first time flying ever. And as we take off, it's clear skies, but then there starts to become a little turbulence. And whenever this happens, normally I look at the flight attendant. That's my strategy. And I see their calm faces, and I just remember, turbulence is normal. It's not a big deal. But things take a quick turn. Lightning starts flashing outside the window. Rain is slamming against the windows, and the plane starts convulsing up and down. It's jerking like a wild horse. And when I look at the flight attendant, I don't see calm. I see fear and trembling as she runs to find her seat in panic, and we are surrounded by chaos. The pilot is saying something in Spanish, and it sounds scary, but I didn't pay enough attention in high school Spanish class, so I have no clue what he's saying at all, but it feels important. And an older lady is sitting next to us, and she is clenching her eyes and hands, and she's praying in Spanish. People are yelling and crying, and two high schoolers turn to us in panic, and we put on a brave face and we're like, oh, this is normal. This is just how flights happen. This is just what happens. After they turn around, though, the plane is now like slamming violently up and down, side to side, and we prepare for the worst. Lori says to me, I'll never forget, she says, I don't want to die on this plane. And so we hold hands and we pray, wondering if this is the end. And shockingly, a sense of calm in this moment starts sweeping over me. And it's not like a heroic, courageous way or in a super spiritual way. But I realize this truth. In this moment, there is literally nothing I can do. It's scary, sure. I don't know what will happen. But it doesn't matter what I do. Things are out of my control. Out of my control. And it's crazy with flying, right? We do it all the time. Some of you guys do it with business a lot. It's part of our lives, but we are essentially completely surrendering to the plane, to the pilots, to God, if you will. We have no control. And by the way, for those of you wondering, spoiler alert, we didn't crash. We made it out alive. Letting go of control is hard. Captain Obvious here. Letting go of control is hard. I'm curious, how many of you would say, with a raise of hands, you are a self-diagnosed control freak? Okay, some of you, yeah. Some of you are not raising your hands. Person next to you is like, oh, that's not true. you know, it's all good here. We can live in this reality because some of us, or all of us, have some level of control freak in us in different areas, right? Some of us are calendar control freaks. We have this friend, literally, if we mention to her this idea, like, hey, we should go camping together sometime, within hours, she has found a campsite 6 months in advance, and she's put down a deposit. And I'm like, I don't even know if I still want to go camping in 6 months. I don't even know if I'll be alive in 6 months. There are control freaks who, you know, sort of life plans and dreams and goals. You have a 10-year plan for your career or your school, and you won't allow anything to get in the way. But when the economy tanks or you tear an ACL, the whole plan gets thrown out of whack. There are perfectionist control freaks. Maybe some of you know some of these kind of people. You offer to help them clean something, and they're sort of staring at you the whole time. And then at some point, they come and grab the broom, and they're just like, just let me do it. You're not doing it right. Some people control their environment, routine. My stuff belongs here. I eat dinner at this time. I color code my socks. That's just what I do. Some control their relationships, like their kids. No matter how hard we try to control things, we have this part of us, this deep part, this scary reality that knows the truth. It's an illusion. We think we have control. We pretend control is possible, but deep down, we have way less control than we want to admit. But letting go feels nearly impossible, because usually the desire for control comes from some kind of fear or insecurity, a past hurt or a past pain, and we don't want to be hurt again. We don't want to be taken by surprise. So today we're going to look at these last words of Jesus and at this tension we feel and how Jesus approached control. So, like I mentioned, for weeks now, we've been looking at these parting words, and now we're in Luke 23, and we see the last thing he says. It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m, while the sun's light failed, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. We talked about this last week. The temple was the place where heaven and earth united, but there was a curtain and systems that would keep people from entering in. And Jesus says, now I am the temple. So the curtain is ripped in two. And Jesus, crying with a loud voice, said, let's all say this out loud together. Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. Having said this, he breathed his last. So an important observation to start. First, Jesus, again, like an earlier phrase on the cross, he's quoting from a psalm. N.T. Wright says about the Psalms were the hymn book that Jesus and his first followers would have known by heart. What Jesus believed and understood about his own identity and vocation came within a psalm-shaped world. And so right away, it's interesting to think about, like, how immersed he was in the scriptures, and then to ask the question, honestly to ourselves, what do I know by heart? What is my brain immersed in? What am I constantly reading, listening to, reflecting on? And I know all of you are pretty perfect and very Jesus-like, but for me, if I'm honest, it's typically Chicago Cubs baseball stats, or quotes from movies, or lyrics of Radiohead songs. But in this moment, Jesus quotes from what he knows. Psalm 31 says, you are indeed my rock and my fortress. For your name's sake, lead me, guide me. Take me out of the net that is hidden from me, for you are my refuge. And then the psalmist says, into your hand I commit my spirit. It's a psalm of deliverance and trust. So he quotes a psalm and he prays, but what's the essence of this prayer? It's these three words, into your hands. Into your hands. It's a release, a surrender, a letting go. What do we say when something isn't going according to plan and we feel the need to control it? We say, I'm taking this into my own hands. And this phrase is the opposite of that. I'm letting go and releasing into your hands. Now, Bible scholars out there, do you know who else quoted this same psalm, Psalm 31, earlier in the Bible? Anybody? Okay, you all flunk the class for today. Just kidding. Jonah actually quoted this. Jonah was in the belly of the fish, and he used Psalm 31 as a foundation for his prayer. Now, what's fascinating here is there's a contrast between Jonah and Jesus. God sends Jonah on a mission, right? And it's a scary, uncertain mission to a wicked place called Nineveh. And how does Jonah respond? He takes things into his own hands. The mission is too hard, scary, so he runs away. God can't tell him what to do. He is in control of his own life. But then we contrast this with Jesus. We see examples of him throughout his life and ministry. Last week we talked about him explaining that his work is to do the will of the Father. Not mine, but yours. Before the cross, there's this image of him in the garden on his knees praying fervently, knowing the mission in front of him is hard. But ultimately, what does he say? He says, not my will, but yours. your hands, into your hands. Now, there's a word that can be used for this, but I'm hesitant to use it, if I'm honest, because so many religious and like Christian words can become so cheesy, they start losing their impact. You know what I'm talking about? Here's the word. The word is faith. And I'm hesitant because it's one of those words that gets overly, inappropriately used in our culture. Maybe you instantly think of this iconic image of George Michael in his denim jeans. They don't make them like they used to. Like what he's singing about there has nothing to do with our kind of faith. In culture, the word faith can be used in sports and relationships and disappointments. In the Christian world, it's even worse. We use faith everywhere. We use them on bumper stickers, on shirts. Got faith? That's a good message to have on a shirt, right? Got faith? Another shirt I found. Faith, it's like Wi-Fi. It's invisible, but it has the power to connect you to what you need. It's good stuff, right? Nothing like Christian subculture shirts. Maybe even worse, though. You remember a time in your life of difficulty and pain, and you authentically shared with someone. And instead of showing empathy or compassion, a Christian says to you, you just got to have faith. It can sometimes be used to keep people from asking hard and good questions or having doubts about God and theology. You just got to have faith. But faith is not about never having doubts or asking questions or wrestling with hard things. The author Anne Lamott writes, the opposite of faith is not doubt, but certainty. In the Bible, faith is more about courage. It's when you're facing the unknown and uncertain, but you let go. Uncertainty and control are bound together. We try to control things because we don't want uncertainty. It's so scary to do something without knowing the results. But just imagine for a second with me how many beautiful and fun things in life would never happen without risking in the face of uncertainty. Asking someone out on a date is terrifying. Moving to a new place, scary. Riding a bike, do you remember that? Applying for a job or school, taking a step of leadership. All uncertain outcomes, but important. In the Bible, in Hebrews 11, there's a classic chapter, and it's often simply called the faith chapter. This writer lists all the people who have risked their lives without having certainty of the results. We see this in verse 32. What more should I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched raging fire, escaped the edge of the sword, won strength out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. We may never quench a raging fire or conquer a kingdom, but the reality is human life is about facing uncertainty. If we're going to live a life of adventure or mission, it will require risking and letting go. Now, because of the difficulty of this word faith, there's an image that's helped me think through this concept, and it comes from the writer and author Henry Nouwen, who's been one of the most influential people in my life. And Henry was in love with the circus, and he started hanging out with a family of trapeze artists. And in the trapeze worlds, there are flyers and there are catchers, okay? The flyers are the ones we typically think about. They're soaring through the air, doing twists and flips, and they are the heroes. But Henry talked to one of the flyers, and this flyer said to him, you know, everyone looks in wonder at what I do, and they say how great I am, but in reality, I don't do anything. The real work comes from the catcher. See, the flyer's job is to stick out their hands and simply trust the catcher. If the flyer tries to squeeze or grab or reach out, it can actually be very dangerous. The arms could slip away, bones could even break. The flyer's real work, get this, is to learn how to let go, to risk, to fly, and then to trust that the catcher will be there. I don't know about you, but sometimes I watch amazing feats like this, and I think to myself, that's not so hard. I could do that. The Olympics are coming this summer, and I do this. I don't watch a single pole vault event for 4 years, but once it starts, I'm like, oh, he's not putting his hands in the right position. That's going to come back to bite him in the long run. But can you imagine, put yourself in that position, how scary that actually is to just release, let go, fly out in the air, and then to just blindly reach out your arms and trust someone will catch you. This is a picture of faith. Into your hands, I commit my spirit. When facing uncertainty and the unknown, it's scary, and there's a voice that tells us to control, take things into your own hands. But it's an illusion. We don't have control. We don't have the power. And I know you guys know what I'm talking about. Maybe for some of you, you're remembering back in your life something you felt called to or led to, but it required risk and uncertainty, and that won over, and you never let go and stepped out. And maybe you wonder to this day what could have been. For others, maybe you're thinking of something in your life, like right now, you feel a combination of excitement and passion, but also fear and anxiety. Maybe this is your Creator leading you to a place of flying out on faith. And it's easier to talk about at church. I get this. But are there areas, if you're truly honest, maybe you wouldn't say it to anybody else, but you have a hard time saying into your hands? Maybe it's your finances or resources. In theory, that sounds good. But in reality, you want to control those. You earn those. Your kids, you want the best. You love them. How can you let them go? Your time, it's so precious. How can you release it to God when you only have so much? And we talk a lot about being a church on mission. To be on mission is to take action and go. It's the sense of being sent by God to places of uncertainty and unknown, to let go of the need to control and just to trust the catcher. So right now we're going to hear from a couple in our community who have entered into this unknown state, willing to risk for this mission. And so I'm going to go ahead and ask Matt and Tiffany to come up. Can we give it up for Matt and Tiffany? And a lot of you will know their journey and how they have longed to live missionally, and specifically through this robotics team. Did you guys get it figured out? Okay, still working through it. Okay. But this team has done some amazing stuff, and we're going to talk about that in a second, but also we're going to just talk about how risk has played a role in their lives. So you want to grab that mic right there? And just ask you guys a few questions. Maybe give us a little backstory. What led you to move where you currently live and what this robotics team has to do with it?
Sure. Yeah, long time ago, we arrived at Highway. It's a very long time ago, it feels like now, 2009. And we got connected with some pretty awesome people in the community here, the Joes, John Liotti, and folks that were doing a lot of work and living in East Palo Alto. And so, I got my start. I was doing the financial literacy mentorship, something. I was terrible at it, probably. I got connected in with the community there, also through BCM, now Hope Horizon. And then when we got married, Tiff got a job at EPEX. Did you want to talk about that?
Sure. So I started working at East Palo Alto Charter School. Early on in our dating relationship, we had been talking to all these people who had moved into East Palo Alto, and Matt was like, you know, have you ever got a job in East Palo Alto? Would you ever move there? And I said, definitely not. And then I got a job in East Palo Alto, and then we moved to East Palo Alto. We just wanted to be part of the community in a more integrated way, not just coming from outside. And so that's how brought us to East Palo Alto in the first place.
Yep. So, yeah, we've been in EPA since, 2011, so over 10 years. How did we end up I guess, with our house. That's maybe a whole other whole other story there. So we, you know, I've been volunteering with the Hope Horizon Lego robotics team, and we'll get to why this is not the same kind of robotics team that we're doing now. But actually, it was, and we've been coaching with Greg over here, who's been, like, the two of us have been doing this for over, like, just about a decade now, I think, right? And so the owner of the house right in front of BCM was like, hey, I want to sell this, and I want it to go to somebody who's, like, invested in the community, not just, like, a developer or whatever. And that's, first of all, kind of like a weird conversation to have in general. Like, nobody just offers a house to anybody in the Bay Area, I feel like. but they spoke with Greg about it, and Greg was like, yeah, I think I know somebody who's looking for this. And so one of the things he knew about us is that we had been looking to buy a home, but not necessarily, we didn't want it to be something that was just for us. Like, we felt like, you know, it's a privilege to be even able to consider buying a home in the Bay Area. And so we had been kind of thinking through a lot of things related to how can we do something that's not just, you know, a nice home for ourselves in the area. And so Tiff can maybe tell you a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and so then we, you know, got connected. Greg was like, Matt's looking for a house. We got connected to them, and everything just felt like it was working out. They wanted to sell it off market and just basically sell it directly to us. There was no competition. They're like, this is the price. But we were like, okay, we pay the price. And we just felt like so much peace from God, and we just like prayed about it and like had a lot of affirmation. We like felt really good. Like, this is where God was calling us. This is like everything was just like really coming together. So then we bought the house in 2017, and then we lived happily ever after. and then we encountered like hurdle after hurdle after hurdle. The East Palta didn't have the water rights, so then we couldn't build anything. And then they got a quote from a contractor. It was like way more expensive than we ever thought it was going to be. And in the meantime, our community had kind of fallen apart. We're like originally Pally Highway people, and that community split, and then Highway PACC, and then just being our age and our life stage, a lot of our friends moved away, and we were just feeling really discouraged. We had a baby in our one-bedroom apartment until he was 2 and a half. While we owned a house over there somewhere that was just sitting, so we were in this place where we were just, like, super discouraged and super disheartened about everything related to the house. I would say I even like it was one trigger for me to have kind of a crisis of faith in my own life spiritually, of just feeling like, you know, God, we followed you brought us here, and then you just left us just to hang out over here.
So yeah, but then it was happily ever after.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, we had all this idea that we wanted to have this home that was for community in some way, and I think in our minds it was like, oh, like maybe we'll have a community of some of our other, you know, friends who are invested in East Palo Alto living, you know, with us in this home, or maybe it'll be the way that we can, I don't know, chip away at that housing crisis, which is, you know, just sounds really incredibly naive, like looking back on it, just being able to offer, you know, below market housing or something like that. And it's just like, it's very, we had all these other ideas, and I always had kind of in the back of my mind, not just from our community here, but even in my upbringing, my grandparents' house, people would call Grand Central Station. They were a gathering place for their neighborhood. And so in my mind, I kind of had that as a little bit of an archetype that was, in a lot of ways, maybe feeding some of the dissatisfaction that I had around what was transpiring and not moving into this house and having difficulty even doing remodels and being able to afford that. So what ended up happening was the Lego robotics team that we had been coaching for 5 years at that time, about 5 years, all of those students who had started in fourth grade were now in high school, and they are not allowed to compete in Lego robotics anymore. And so the only option was to move up to the high school level competition, which they all said they wanted to do. We built a prototype robot in our little, you know, room at Hope Horizon, and that was enough space to build a prototype robot and bring it around and recruit students, but it's not enough to actually run a high school level robotics team. And so the team needed a workshop. We had a garage. The garage became the workshop, and it still is the workshop, actually. And so initially, I think we were just like, well, this is a useful thing that we can do with it while we figure out financially how to, you know, do the remodel, like get some people into housing here. Like this kind, we kind of had this thing in the parallel happening as we're like, in retrospect, and honestly, until we like talked about this last night, I didn't fully draw the connections, but it's like the community that I think we're building now in our home is not around just our church community or our housing or whatever. It's actually around the robotics team. So now the robotics team has essentially been living in that portion of not just our garage, but also the first like three rooms of the house. That's our workshop, that's our lab, and that's the space where all the magic happens for the team at this point. And it's really a community of the whole team, the students, the coaches. There's community built amongst the all the students have a great team culture. Their alumni have come back to visit multiple times. Now we have two classes of alumni, Greg, right? So two classes of alumni that have come back to like visit. They also chat with everyone on Slack and stuff. There's a real community built there amongst the students, also among the coaches, and among the whole team. And I think that's something that's really been, I think, special for us to recognize. And we've, even as all of that was happening, we're still like, okay, well, we gotta figure out this whole thing, we gotta get this remodeled and do housing, et cetera. And like, one thing we've recognized as well is like, we actually are in a pretty special location where we're at. We're actually kind of in basically like high school row in East Palo Alto. There's four high schools within a block of us. They're all, you know, they're charter high schools. There's actually no public high school in East Palo Alto. All these Palo Alto kids have to go to Menlo Atherton for if they're in the regular Ravenswood district. But there's a bunch of high schools right near us, and that actually makes it a lot easier for the students to walk over, either from school or from home, to be at the workshop, which is huge for the students. And so I think there's a lot of things that we've started to, once we maybe let go of it a little bit more, like we've recognized how there's all these little attributes that we've been guided into, and now it's Grand Central Station for the robotics team. And so that's kind of how that's set up.
Nice. So a little bit has gone on in the past few years.
Just a little bit.
So you've already...
We eventually move into the... Well, we actually did an ADU and we live there. So we're
crazy
in this little two-bedroom place in the back while the robotics team has the rest of the place.
Yeah. So you've already alluded to this, but we're talking about risking and letting go of control. Can you guys just speak in briefly to us? Like, what does that look like for you in this journey?
I mean, I think it's been very risky. Like, you know that ocean song, the Hillsong song, that's like, Spirit lead me where my trust is without borders. You walk upon the water wherever you will call me. When I heard that song before this house, I was like, yes, like, lead me wherever. I lived in China for 2 years, like, where I got this. And now when I hear that song, I just think, are you sure? I think God has called us into this, and it has been risky, and we have not felt like we've known where things are going all the time. And don't get me wrong, we've seen like some incredible blessings from our home itself and from the orchard. That's a whole other story, this orchard we have. And that has been a huge blessing, and I think we've seen the robotics team grow in huge ways that we'll share about. But it has been really hard to decide, okay, we have to let go of these ideals, of this thought, this plan that we had in our minds. It's hard to like strive against the Silicon Valley values of like all for me, and so I think we have struggled with that. I think still now on a daily, weekly basis of like, okay, how do we let go of this? How do we just trust that this is going to be and work out the way that it needs to?
Yeah, thanks for sharing. Okay, so we've already alluded to this, but robotics team has some pretty amazing news. Can you tell us about it, and then how we can support you as your church community?
Yeah, so the team has come a long way since that first prototype robot. So last year, they actually had some great success building a super simple, effective robot, and they were captains in every competition they went to last year. And that kind of, I think, set a vision for a lot of the students this year, that it wasn't just like, oh, we're going to show up to competition, and maybe we'll rank in the bottom quartile, and hopefully one of the big teams picks us for the playoffs. Because it's a 3-versus-3 competition, so you compete with two other teams. I think that idea that we can be that captain actually changed the vision for the team this year. And so they, this year, at our first competition, we were at the Silicon Valley Regional, the team put together a great robot and a great performance with a few mistakes that happened along the way. So we actually ended up ranking pretty low and seeding low in the rankings. But we proved ourselves to the top teams at that event. And this is what I told the students, to just show up, be reliable, show that you can do what you can do. And that's what they did. The students have done. They built a great robot. They were disciplined about competing with it. And when the time came for picking the alliances, the number one alliance chose us to join them. And then we proceeded to go and stomp through most of the playoffs, which was awesome. And it all came down, though, it's a best of three. We went to the tiebreaker at the very end, and at the very end, we prevailed and won, and we're going to the World Championships as a team. And so, and then to follow up on that, we had our second regional that we went to up in Sacramento, just to prove that we could also do this on our own power as well. We jumped from our 30th seed showing at Silicon Valley Regional to 5th seed captain at the Sacramento Regional, and also went into deep in the playoffs there. And so the team, I think, has really like shown what they're capable of. And if you look at, this is a very like nerdy subculture, by the way. There's a like, if you're aware of like 538, like stats kind of stuff, like there's a version of that for robotics called Statbotics for all these high school teams. And so on Statbotics, it shows we're performing at about the top 11% of the world. And so that's pretty amazing for a team that's been together for about 4 or 5 years now. And I'm really proud of the students. They've done just an incredible job building, not only from a technology standpoint, but from a team culture standpoint, and getting to this point. And so they're super excited to be going to Worlds now. And that's been our big challenge, is getting the whole team out there. It's not cheap to send, you know, 20-some people, plus a robot, plus parts, plus pit equipment and everything. Like, that's like a 4-day competition. Fortunately, though, through that process.
Yeah, so we have been fundraising like crazy for the past 3 weeks, and I think that the link was sent out in the newsletter. We are almost there on the fundraiser, and we think, based on some promises, we actually might be fully funded. So we thought we were going to up here and ask you all to help us chip in, so if you want to do that, you still can, but I think we actually might be good. But we have a different ask if you are still interested in helping with robotics.
Yes. So, and also, we need to do that fundraising every year. So if you know that anybody in your... So, like, we won't, like, hopefully we go to Worlds every year. That would be really cool. But it's also very expensive just to run it year to year and go to multiple competitions, things like that. So if your company does sponsorships and things like that, anything ongoing would be awesome with the team. So you can talk to us about that. But more importantly, this has gotten a lot of exposure for the team. So it's been in the news. A lot of East Palo Alto folks that I've just like run into, they're like, hey, I heard there's a robotics team that's going to Worlds. Like, that's really cool. The Churobots are so cool. And like, I never told them about that. And so like, there's a lot of people now that are aware of the Churobots in the community who are pretty excited. And we anticipate that there'll be a lot more students joining the team next year, because we have a lot more visibility in the community. And so with more students comes the need for more coaches. And we would love to have, as part of this kind of community that we've been talking about, that's not just the students, not just the team as a whole, but also the coaching community, we'd love for that to be part of what we're building there. And so we'd love for Highwayers to consider joining as a coach or mentor on the team. And this is not, you don't need to be an engineer. It's not, the team doesn't run just as a strictly STEM type program. There's a lot of business development, marketing, media, there's stats, there's scouting strategy. There's a lot of aspects to this, and some of it is just having basic project management and willingness to work with high schoolers and be somebody who can help them out. I mean, we have students who, you know, we told them they need to keep their grades up to go to Worlds, because otherwise their teachers are not going to let them go, or their parents are not going to let them go. And so there's even some tutoring that we're doing to help some of our students get there as well. And so even if you're just coming and you're just good at working with high schoolers and you can tutor them, please consider joining us, because the more coaches we have, the more we can support all those students on the existing team and all the new students that we anticipate or we hope will join the team in the future.
Amazing. Thank you guys so much. Can we thank them again? Let's worth doing the coaching thing. If nothing else, just get one of those t-shirts. So we're going to end our time here in a moment with communion. And I just appreciate Matt and Tiffany and Greg, what you're doing, and so many of you in other spaces being on mission. And I love what they said, letting go of control. And it's not a clean thing that happens. It's messy. Trust, faith is a messy ordeal. And we think of the statements that Jesus makes at the end of his life, and it applies to us in life, but then it applies to us in death. And death is not something we talk about a lot in our culture. We typically distract ourselves. We numb ourselves. But I can't be the only one who is laid in bed at night, and you've had that moment where the reality hits you. This reality, one day I will die. I will breathe my last. And the reality sinks in, and it can be terrifying. This is the greatest unknown. This is the greatest uncertainty. There's this old children's bedtime prayer. I'm wondering if any of you grew up praying it. It says, "Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take." And on first read, it sounds horribly creepy and morbid. Anne Lamott, the author I referenced earlier, tells this story. She didn't grow up Christian, and she visited a family. And she says this. She says, "Wait, what? What did you say? I could die in my sleep. I'm only 7 years old." She says, "That so did not work for me, especially in the dark in a strange home. Don't be taking my soul. You leave my soul right here in my 50-pound body." And I love that. I get that. But when you think about it, this is originally written in the 1600s. One of the more amazing things about our modern times is how much infant and child mortality has gone down. In previous centuries, to make it to 10 years old wasn't always guaranteed or expected even. So this prayer becomes a release, a letting go. I can't control my soul. I can't control my mortality. So I say, into your hands, I commit my soul. And we're an intergenerational church. We'll be in different places. Some of you are in the younger side, and you don't ever think about this reality. Others of you, maybe you realize the final day is getting closer and closer. Regardless of our age, it will happen to us. As I sat on that plane leaving from Guatemala, it was one of those moments where I really thought that day was here. And just as I had no control flying on the plane, we also have no control of this moment when we will breathe our last. It's the ultimate version of letting go. So the question is, will you be willing to trust the catcher? At that moment, will you be able to say, into your hands, I commend my spirit, letting go and having faith that God will be there to catch you? Would you close your eyes, bow your heads with me? Before we take communion, I just want to acknowledge that in this room, maybe some of us have never taken that first step of trusting and letting go to make Jesus the one that is our catcher, our savior. And if that's you, I'm going to be standing at the front of the stage after our service. And I'd love to just talk to you more about that. What does it mean to trust Jesus in life and in death? Now, God, we come to you as this time of communion, and we want to remember this reality that we are not God. For many of us, we live our lives believing that in theory, but in practice, we take the role of a God, doing what we want, our agenda, our control. Would you teach us to trust you, the catcher? In the moments of uncertainty and unknown, would you lead us? As we take this moment of communion, remind us of what you've done on the cross. As we enter into this Good Friday week, before Easter, help us to sink deep into this journey of pain that you took out of love for us. So it's in Jesus' name we all pray. Amen.